at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted. The Program Advisory Committee meets the second Tuesday of each month at 6 p.m. Please call 503-231-8032 to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from PDX Pendable Stage and Studio Supplies. PDX Pendable sells and rents to film and theater productions, from gel and globes to paint and lights, featuring the latest Arri LED lighting. More information available at 503-887-5880 and at pdxpendables.com.
Andy Wawa looks a scream. Andy Mona, whoa, whoa, whoa. Andy Wawa, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Lowry Sims. She's an independent art curator, and she's here to talk about Art and Race Matters, the career of Robert Colescott, which is on now at the Portland Art Museum through May 17th. Welcome to KBOO, Lowry.
Thank you. It's lovely to be here.
So you're visiting from your home on the East Coast, yes. Baltimore, mm-hmm. and you're here to sort of kick off this exhibition.
Yes.
It's a whole survey of Robert Colescott paintings.
Yeah, actually, it's the first complete survey of his work from the 1940s through the 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
Previous exhibitions in 87, 97, 2007 just did 10 previous years. So this is the one opportunity for the public to really see where he started from the beginning, and most importantly, to sort of see what he was doing when he was in residence here in Portland
mm-hmm.
in the 60s and for several years where he taught at Portland State University.
Yeah. So he in a way, he's a Bay Area painter, but he's kind of known locally because PSU, and he was collected by Arlene Schnitzer. So you see his work in the Portland Art Museum and at the Jordan Schnitzer Museums. So he's kind of local, but not. Mm-hmm. Just tell us, as you go into the show, which is a fantastic show, very big, colorful paintings. It's mm-hmm. like very easy on the eye. As you go in, there's a painting called 1919.
Yes.
And it's a map of America, state map. And there's a soldier on the right and a woman on the left. And an arrow coming out of New Orleans pointing west, and it says go west,
yes.
right, somewhere in the middle.
Exactly.
Who's the soldier and who's the woman?
Well, this is a painting that commemorates his parents' marriage and very subsequent migration from New Orleans to Oakland to create a situation where their children would have more opportunity. It was a very complex family. They were black people of different hues. His family was marked by different individuals passing for white, which was a strategy for success at a certain point for African Americans.
So his mom could pass, is
yeah.
that right? But his dad couldn't.
No, his dad right. was a little more. And there was a sort of a difference in hue between his brother and he. And it, the sort of like around the mid-80s when Robert was getting more renown, his brother Warrington, who was teaching at the University of Madison.
And he's a printmaker, his brother.
Fabulous printmaker.
Yeah.
And in fact, Mary Chapin Weaver, who's a curator at the Portland Museum, did a wonderful retrospective of Warrington Colescott a couple of years ago. And so, you know, Warrington sort of had to come out. So I think he sort of fudged it a bit and called himself Creole,
mm-hmm.
Which was a way that people, particularly around the New Orleans area, would sort of talk about somebody who was mixed race
mm-hmm.
In that sense. Yeah.
So his mom and dad moved to the Bay Area right. For a better life, basically.
Exactly.
And had two boys,
mm-hmm.
both artists.
Mm-hmm.
And how did Robert kind of take his artistic, like he was in, they were both in the Second World War, the boys.
They both did, yeah. Robert sort of lied a bit because he was a bit younger. And it's interesting because my father was also in World War II, and he was in a Negro unit, a so-called Negro unit in the Pacific. But Robert and his brother were in regular battalion units. And when he came back, he went to graduate school, Sacramento State first, and then went to Berkeley. And that's when he really sort of found himself as an artist. And then once he got his master's, he went to Paris on the GI Bill, and he studied in the studio of Fernand Léger. And this was something a lot of American artists had done since the 19th century. And there were specific artists like Jérôme and Léger who were known for taking in artists and sort of training them. And it was sort of basically in Paris dealing with Léger that he sort of moved away from abstraction, which was really gaining traction here in the States, to a realization that figuration was the way he would go. And you described him as a Bay Area figurationist, which is kind of like a misnomer, because he didn't get to the Bay Area, ironically, until the 1970s, because he sort of went, you know, from, you know, sort of graduate school and Paris, you know, to Seattle and then, you know, Portland. But very much caught up in this kind of West Coast ethos that's very different from the East Coast. And I think in the 1969-70, when he would have been settling in Oakland, that's right at the moment where funk art and sort of the counterculture was flourishing with R. Crumb, you know, the cartoonist, and he was very close to Joan Brown, William Wiley, Roy DeForest, H.A. Arneson, all those kind of artists who are sort of doing this kind of off-kilter kind of art, which I think really began to sort of influence him. And he could bring all of the elements of his past into this kind of creative environment that sort of would have a place for that kind of subject matter.
There's one painting from 1979 that I think Portlanders would know, because it was in the stairwell as you go down.
Right.
Like you're going to see a movie, you go down that stairwell to the underground Link Gallery. And it's called Beauty is in the Eye of the Beholder.
Yeah.
So it's a woman in kind of lingerie,
right,
with her back to the viewer. You see her bum, basically. And there's him looking back from the canvas at her and at the viewer, sort of.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, sort of dirty old man, maybe, you know, what's going on?
Well,
here?
It's one of those artists in the studio kinds of situations. So it's a very interesting painting because he is turning away from a large reproduction of Matisse's 1906 painting, The Dance, which is in the Hermitage, but looking at the model, who is sort of, we assume, undressing to sort of pose for him in the nude. And he once noted to Joe Lewis, the artist and art historian, that this painting sort of reflects the fact that he was always caught between these sort of painted ideal women from art history and the sort of, you know, flesh and blood, you know, real women that he had to sort of deal with in his own life. So it's this kind of dilemma, you know, that he always faced, I think, and sort of really marked his attitude towards women and in general that was very kind of generational.
Generational, meaning we wouldn't put up with it today.
I didn't put up with it when I knew him in the 70s.
Oh, you didn't.
90s. Yeah, Bob was like 24 25 years older than me, and I just go roll my eyes, you know, at his, you know, sort of attitudes. He's much more a kind of even predating, you know, sort of like a madman Hugh Hefner, you know, kind of situation. But the interesting thing, I mean, one of the aspects, obviously, in organizing the show was to sort of deal with, you know, some of the raunchier or difficult, you know, presentations of women. But he always sort of put himself, he implicated himself in his own obsessions. And that's the part that I think is fairly honest, you know, about him. He'll put himself as a peeping Tom looking in on the scene, or, you know, as he did in Beauty in the Eye of the Beholder, sort of presenting himself as a, in this dilemma, you know, like sort of caught between life and art in his art in many ways. So, mm-hmm. I think that that's the thing that we have to remember with Bob. He always sort of takes on all the aspects and issues that he challenges with himself.
Mm-hmm. If we jump back to 1949, he was in Leger's mm-hmm. studio, and he did a painting called Relationship.
Yeah.
And it's, this kind of looks like classic modernism from the 20s, you know?
Yeah, definitely. You know, my co-curator, Matthew Wesley, sort of described it as sort of like this kind of mechanistic presentation of, you know, two women sitting at a table with, you know, like an interior. It's a little less so precise than Leger would have done it, but it's very much the way that he's done the angularity of the forms is very similar. And we were thrilled to get this particular painting because, you know, up to that point, Bob in the studio of Leger was kind of urban legend.
Oh, really?
So this was like, you know, oh my God, here's concrete evidence. You know?
His widow had a lot of this stuff and sold it to Blum and Poe, the famous gallery.
Well, they inventoried, you know, the storage and sort of came across it. And then there's a drawing that's a little closer in feeling that is actually called Homage to Leger in the exhibition that sort of really shows this kind of relationship. Now, we can jump ahead to the 1980s and look at a painting called Hard Hats, which is this improbable scene of this couple in the midst of a construction site. Mm-hmm. And there's all sorts of people carrying beams and moving planks and stuff, and they're sitting there, and he has his hard hat on, and she has her a pot
sauce
from
pan.
Her kitchen, her saucepan on her head. And there's a way in which he sort of integrated the figures into this kind of latticework of the construction site that relate to Leger's construction paintings from the 1950s.
Mm-hmm. So he was over there in Paris, you know, trying to be a modernist sort of thing, and then but of a young man, and then he went to Egypt and had a kind of
that was several years later. I mean, he came back. He was in Seattle briefly, and as we talked about in Portland, and then he applied for a residency in the American University in Cairo. And that was about 63, 64. And then he stayed a year, came back, and then he went back, you know, to sort of teach there. And that seems to have been a very catalytic experience for him in terms of figuring out who he was and indicating the future directions that his art would take. I think that, you know, as a person who had grown up in a family with conflicting racial identities, being in Egypt with all sorts of brown and black people really sort of made it clear to what his place was in the world and in the universe.
Clear as in he accepted everyone and his place in it, or he narrowed it down to his own place to...
I think both. You know, I think that, you know, sort of being... You know, it's my perception being an African-American in the Northwest would have been different from, say, the South or the East, you know, in many different ways. And then he was really impacted by paintings and Egyptian models. He talks about the Valley of the Queens series mm-hmm. and says he was haunted by them.
So what is that, the Valley of the Queens?
Well, there are two, like, sort of large burial sites in Egypt for the kings and queens of Egypt. And surprisingly, not everybody has a pyramid. Many of these are sort of subterranean. And you go down, and I was there in 2011, and it was just amazing. I sort of like stood at Hatshepsut's, you know, temple, and then went down to Ramses II's tomb, and I went, I got it, Bob. I understand, you know, like everything. Because the color and the vibrancy that we see in the few examples that we have of the Valley Queen paintings that he did in Egypt is so different from the the tonalities of the work from Portland, you know, which is, you know, much more
muted,
subdued, yeah, you know, very earth tones and things like that. So that gave it a jolt of color, which then he carried over into the 70s.
Were they murals? Were they painting on stone or on caskets or...
His work or...
No, in Egypt.
Oh, everything. I mean, you know, when you go down, there's a lot of wall paintings. Within Hatshepsut's tomb, which is sort of set into a rock, it's one of the larger tombs, there are murals and they're sort of carved into the thing. So there's relief carving, there's painting, and then there are also the sarcophagi and things that you can see both on site and in the museums.
So he came up with a painting. Well, he did some paintings sort of influenced by that, and they're sort of semi-abstract, yeah. They're queens.
They're sort of semi-abstract. You know, like, if you sort of take his statement, he was haunted by these queens, literally, there is a kind of, despite the fact that this is very bright and sort of fully saturated hues, there is a kind of ethereal quality to the figures. They're very fugitive, you know. They're these great swaths of color that sort of fit together like puzzles, and then you sort of see a face and a body sort of floating in between. So I think that they have a hallucinatory gesture, not to say that he took drugs, but that sort of really talk about, you know, like how he was trying to sort of grapple with the tradition that mm-hmm. he saw in Egypt. And then, you know, if you have an opportunity, which unfortunately we couldn't do in this exhibition because of space, but of laying out a group of paintings done, say, between 63 and 69, you begin to see how slowly the forms coalesce. But what he maintains and sort of carries into his compositions is this sort of non-Renaissance perspectival space. So there's no horizon line with everything lining up going in the distance. Things have their own spaces and they sort of float, and it's almost like you have a narrative over here, a narrative over there, and a narrative down there. So those, I think that's the sort of formal legacy that comes out of his time in Egypt,
mm-hmm.
that you begin to see. He sort of loses it a bit in the 70s when he's doing a lot of his appropriations, but by the 80s and 90s, you have these compositions that are just chock full of individual anecdotes that you have to sort of keep track, that sort of relate to the whole story that he wants to tell you.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Lowry Sims. She's here talking about the exhibition Art and Race Matters, The Career of Robert Colescott, which is on at the Portland Art Museum through May 17th. A lot of his work, when you just talked about how there are things kind of floating around, mm-hmm. like anecdotally, so there's a painting of a kind of a shipwreck.
Oh, yes.
As you go in. And yes. There's loads of different things to look at. Everyone's in the sea and the ship's going down, right, in the background. Right. But it's like you piece all these little bits together.
Mm-hmm.
And there's often things like that in his paintings, you know, little symbols sitting, yeah, around.
That's one of his sort of references to art history that's not so direct. Mm-hmm. You know, very often he would take the composition as in George Washington Carver crossing the Delaware and Liberty leading the people, where he sort of stays fairly faithful to the original and just black faces, or Eat Them Taters, which is a version of Van Gogh's Potato Eaters.
Mm-hmm.
But in this particular painting, it's a shipwreck. But, you know, in the Delacroix.
What's the original Delacroix?
It's the Delacroix, the Raft of the Medusa.
That's a...
A raft of people under the, and there's this sort of climbing up the mast, trying to wave at, you know, another ship for rescue. In here, the different body parts and different objects, and they're all detritus in the sea scattered around. So it's kind, and then in the back you see a ship, you know, sort mm-hmm. of sinking. And you see there's a little figure popping up with his glasses and gray hair, and that's Bob.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little basket with a child in it that, you know, the
could be Moses
you, yeah, know, being found, you know, in Egypt again. And, you know, a guy swimming towards a lady who's hanging on to a suitcase that has Avon on it. So it's all this kind of, like, really amusing sort of bits of things. But if you're sort of thinking about approaches to the composition in terms of art history, it's almost like an all-over painting because there is no like one point of focus. So he's sort of using figural elements to do something that's comparable to what abstract expressionism was about, particularly Jackson Pollock's work.
Mm-hmm. When you get to Les Demoiselles d'Alabama.
Yeah.
So this is a take off of a famous painting, but he's put black women in.
Yeah, it's there are two paintings. So the sort of source of the painting, of course, is Picasso's 1907 Demoiselle d'Avignon in the collection of the Museum of Modern Art. So he did two paintings, one of them closer to the Picasso nude, which he called Desnuda, and he did another one, Vestida. So the subplot on that, of course, is the two versions of a nude woman called the Naked Maja that Goya did, and he did one nude and he did one clothed. So you have to like figure out all these different, you know, things. So the one version of the demoiselle we have, they have clothing on. So the figures are ambiguous. I think you can call them blackface in the terms that their forms have been informed by African sculptures, but they have blonde hair and, you know, as Bob does, and some have dark, browner skin and others have lighter skin. But the whole idea was something that that reminds me of what André Breton talked about when he was looking at Picasso and Wilfredo Lam, the great Cuban surrealist. Now, Wilfredo was from Cuba. He had grown up in a kind of Afro-Cuban context. So Breton said Picasso and Lam were on two ends of a scale between civilization and primitivism, and they came and they met in the middle. And so that's essentially what Bob says. You know, he says Picasso started out with a Europeanism and arrived at Africanism, and then he took an Africanism and was turning it back into a Europeanism, so that his figures compared to the Picasso are much fully developed. They're dressed in, you know, very hot 80s, you know, kind of clothing. So it's a kind of dialogue between sort of mainstream appropriation of African cultures and then a response from a person from an African-based culture to that particular work.
Mm-hmm. So as you go through the exhibition, you know, you're seeing all these art historical references.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's also this other theme of the sort of Aunt Jemima pops up and,
yeah,
you know, racist imagery from the American,
right,
20th century,
right,
basically. Which makes people a lot more uncomfortable today.
Yes.
Because, you know, you can be caught out if you say the wrong thing. But he's doing it all. I presume when he was doing it, he could be funny about it and not be challenged. He was challenging the viewer.
Yeah, I think he's using humor, but the quote from him is always, humor is the bait. And once he gets you get hooked, then he drags you into this kind of psychological dialogue that really sort of impugns your attitudes, not his necessarily. And something like Eat Them Taters is really an interesting piece because it's very closely based on the potato eaters. And what he's done is he's made the skin very dark and the lips white. So they look like they're sort of from the minstrel tradition. But if you look very carefully, because we've reproduced the original painting next to it, the features in the Van Gogh, these are not idealized classical features.
No, these
features.
Are peasants.
They're peasants, and it's very kind of like worn and animalistic and stuff, and he catches the sort of eye at an angle of one of the figures on the right. So when you look at it, it's not really all that caricatured. It sort of follows very much what Van Gogh was doing with these sort of like really, you know, suppressed, you know, poor, downtrodden, you know, Dutch peasants. But he's putting it into a black context and sort of illustrating how black people could find humor in even the most, you know, kind of, you know, crazy, you know, and sort of troublesome, you know, situations. So it's one could see it as an affirmation of, you know, the resiliency, you know, like of Black life to a certain extent. But I think everybody gets stopped by the fact that they look like minstrels,
mm-hmm.
and don't sort of really think it through as to what he's really talking mm-hmm. about.
Another similar one is Shirley Temple Black.
Ah.
And the Bojangles guy. What's his name?
Bojangles White.
Yeah. Right, okay. So he reverses the
races.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's sort of like a kind of obvious trick, because Shirley Temple was married to a man named Charles Black. So he takes the fact that her full mm-hmm. married name is Shirley Temple Black. So then if you paint it Shirley Temple Black, then of course Bill Bojangles has to be white instead mm-hmm. of black. And I think that's a painting where the what if kinds of questions lead you to, would America consider a young black girl in the 1930s as a candidate to be America's sweetheart, the way that Shirley Temple was? And what would be our tolerance to sort of see a white man in a similar subservient, accommodating, shuffling presence that Bill Bojangles had to attempt and sort of put on? And it's only in brief spurts in all the movies that he appeared in that you get to what a fantastic dancer he was, you know. So it's really about what we think about people when we see them and the kind of assumptions that we make and what we accept as sort of appropriate behavior and appearance for them.
Mm-hmm. So in the last room of the show upstairs, you have these big sequences of paintings. Just tell us about one of them.
Okay. I think you're referring to the knowledge of the past as the key to the future. This was an interesting series he started in the 60s. Around 86, 87. And they're sort of taking points of history and showing where there's a kind of lapse in terms of recognition of specific people. The one in the collection of the Portland Museum is Upside Down Jesus, The Politics of Survival. And some people think of it as an anti-Christian situation, because Jesus is on the cross, he's upside down. But it probably refers to the fact that St. Peter, when he was crucified after Christ's death in Rome, he refused to be crucified upside down because he felt that would be sacrilegious, because he was being crucified in the same way that Jesus was. So there's that kind of situation. And then if you look in the sort of sub-stories that are going on, there are lots of people, you know, fishing. There might be a reference to Huckleberry Finn and Jim, maybe a woman accepting money for sexual favors, a woman going through garbage. But it's really about what people have to do for survival that we see every day in the streets, because homelessness is certainly, you know, an important and pervasive problem in this country, you know, right now. Near it would be the Saint Sebastian in the series, which really you see the saint with arrows in his body, but he's bimorphicated. He's black and a female on one side, white and male on the other. And then they're tethered to them are their opposites, you know, like sort of really talking about the taboos around interracial relations.
Mm-hmm.
So in all these things, he's really sort of now taking on much more current issues that still remain very germane today.
Mm-hmm. And then by the end, he had Parkinson's and he couldn't paint as well, right? Because he had shaky limbs, presumably.
Exactly, yeah.
But he did still produce huge paintings. There's one called Sleeping Beauty.
Yes.
It seems to be two canvases together. And it didn't look like he finished it, or he deliberately left it unfinished.
Well, I think there's a series of paintings from that period where, you know, like, I don't know if it was like left unfinished or it was kind of deliberate. Because we have to remember the part that would be considered left unfinished is the part that has the magenta paint, because that's the color he painted on top of. He didn't mm-hmm. paint on top of white. So the white it was probably a more deliberate addition than one would suspect. But I think we really get back to what, in that painting, what Bob wanted to be remembered as, and that was as a great painter.
What is it to do with Sleeping Beauty?
I don't know. You know how the artists are with these titles. I have no idea. I suppose she's in there somewhere. you know, like I hope people, you know, come to see the show and they sort of begin to understand the logic behind Colescott's work. I think seeing a complete survey of his work and how he indulged in some of the things that we see in later work early on will sort of really give you a much fuller picture of what his career is and why he's really an important painter.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Larry Sims. She is an independent curator and was talking about Art and Race Matters, the career of Robert Colescott, which runs now through May 17th at the Portland Art Museum. Thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Andy Warhol looks a scream. Had him on my wall. Andy Warhol, silver screen. Can't tell them apart at all.
Good afternoon. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It is noon, and we wanted to let you know that you can make a valuable impact on KBOO by donating your unused vehicle. And this includes cars, trucks, motorcycles, and even recreational vehicles. Not only can KBOO benefit financially from your donation, but your gift also might qualify as a tax-deductible donation. We can even pick up your vehicle at no charge, even if it's not working. For more info on this program, call KBOO at 503-KBOO123 or go to kboo.fm. As always, we appreciate your support. Thank you. And coming up next is Buscando America, but first these announcements.
Hello. KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Como El Ere, an evening of flamenco featuring direct from Spain guitarist Carlos de Jacoba on Saturday, March 7th from 8 to 9:30 p.m. at Resound Northwest in Portland. Como El Ere, featuring Diego Amador Jr. and hosted by Savannah Fuentes, brings you the intense energy and emotion of flamenco. Again, that's Como El Ere, an evening of flamenco featuring direct from Spain guitarist Carlos de Jacoba on Saturday, March 7th from 8 to 9:30 p.m. at Resound Northwest, 1532 Southwest Jefferson Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.